We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 10, William Shakespeare's History of Hogwarts. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Ian Desher about his Shakespearean adaptations of pop culture works like Star Wars and his thoughts about doing the same for Harry Potter. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds Too.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today we're talking about transforming current pop culture into past pop culture with a little help from the early modern poetic form of iambic pentameter. Emily, you have told me that Shakespeare was one of your earliest fan obsessions. Why was that?
Yes, it's true. I was just drawn to it. I had an excellent teacher, Mr. Tom Geyer at Mount Notre Dame High School, Cincinnati. So I had an excellent, excellent teacher, and he really worked hard to bring the stories to life for us. And he also emphasized, you know, the performance of the plays rather than just reading them. And I think that really all just energized my mind. And I participated in a few Shakespearean acting competitions and actually won myself a Riverside Shakespeare with nothing but my Shakespearean acting skills at age 16. So I'm always very proud of that.
That's wonderful. Yeah, so I also really liked Shakespeare. I would not say like I was like a hardcore Shakespeare fan, but I've always loved poetry and I was a total theater kid in high school and in college. And I always did great when you had to memorize those passages from Shakespeare. And I always picked the ones that where I thought the language the most was the most interesting. And, it's Shakespeare, you can just reread at different phases of your life and you get different things out of it.
Like Harry Potter.
That's correct. As all great literature is transcendent. And so we are delighted today to have with us writer Ian Desher, who has a BA from Yale University, an MA from Yale Divinity School, and a PhD from Union Theological Seminary. Ian has turned his astute academic eyes and creative pen to transforming current popular phenomena like Star Wars and Avengers, as well as past phenomena, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol, into works of Shakespeare, or Shakespeare-like. He also established the Shakespeare 2020 Project to read aloud Shakespeare's works in a public venue. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so delighted to have you here with us today. I've only newly discovered your very clever mashups of Shakespeare and Star Wars. I've been reading the Star Wars adaptations of the original three movies, which are the middle three, Verily A New Hope, The Empire Striketh Back, and The Jedi Doth Return, which are in a very convenient box set. So you can just get them very easily all together. They are so much fun to read and so well done on your part, Ian. And also they're really thought provoking. Where did you get the idea to produce Shakespearean versions of current pop culture hits?
So it was about 9 years ago. Three things happened kind of right around the same time. I got together with some friends of mine, high school buddies of mine, and we watched the entire Star Wars trilogy in a day. which was not anything new for me, but I actually hadn't seen the movies in a few years, so it was sort of revisiting them, sort of coming back home in a way after having not really seen them since before I had children and things like that. So and then not too long after I watched the trilogy, I read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which was one of the first mashup books that became really popular. And then just after finishing that book, my family and I went to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I live in Portland, Oregon, and we went down to Ashland to the Shakespeare Festival there. And it was while we were at the Shakespeare Festival, I sort of attribute it to having Star Wars and mashups and Shakespeare all floating around in my head. And I thought it'd be really fun to take Star Wars and rewrite it as though it were a play by Shakespeare. And I had done, I knew I loved Star Wars and Shakespeare enough that my passion for the project wouldn't be a problem. And I had tried my hand at writing verse over the years a few times. And so, I thought maybe I could make a go of it.
So you've credited some of your teachers with inspiring your love for Shakespeare. And of course, we heard Emily talking about some of the things that her teacher did. What were some of the things your teachers did to help to get you loving Shakespeare?
Yeah, I mean, like you, I was a theater kid, and I had a wonderful English teacher, Jane Bidwell, my freshman year of high school, and she was also my junior year teacher. And she, when we started our unit on Shakespeare and specifically diving into Othello, she also introduced us to poetic feet and meter. And I was a kid who'd grown up with Dr. Seuss and Shel Silverstein and poems like The Night Before Christmas. And so suddenly she was putting a structure around the things that I had loved forever. And then here we were presented with Shakespeare. And as a theater kid, I loved the stories. I loved Iago as a villain. I just loved, I loved the language. I was the nerd who, when my junior year, when we had to memorize the "If it were done when 'tis done" speech from Macbeth, I brought like a fake sword to school to perform it with, and
All the
so
way.
yeah, exactly. No half measures with me. So she did a really good job of helping Shakespeare come alive for us all, and we read read good portions of the plays out loud in class, which I think makes such a difference when you can actually hear the language performed. And it was around the same time that, summer after my sophomore year of high school was when Kenneth Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing came out. And so it was just a really good time to be a young person getting into Shakespeare.
Yeah, I do think Kenneth Branagh did a lot to bring Shakespeare, back into, you can eat some popcorn while you're watching your Shakespeare. I think that's totally in keeping with the globe, that's sort of the idea of the whole thing. And
As
I
it was meant
you
to
have such
be.
a good ear for the iambic pentameter. It makes sense to me that all the, read aloud and the sense of what the meter is doing was a part of your early education. Now, some of the Shakespearean devices that you use very effectively throughout these works are the aside and the soliloquy, which are quite distinctive in that, of course, we don't have really soliloquies in Star Wars. But these actually provide additional insights into the motives, feelings, and personality of the characters. How did you decide where to inject these insightful moments?
Well, I mean, like you said, there are no soliloquies in Star Wars, but what that means is that Star Wars gives us moments that would never happen in Shakespeare, right? So, like Luke Skywalker staring silently out at the double suns of Tatooine would never happen in Shakespeare. Shakespeare's always going to have a character tell you how they're feeling in that moment when they are alone and they're thinking complex thoughts, right? He never has the stage direction. Character looks off into the distance meaningfully, right? Like, you always get to hear what they're feeling, and that is what I think is part of what's so rich about Shakespeare, right? Is he really mines human emotion for everything that's there, and sometimes surprises you with what people are thinking. And so to get to do that with my favorite Star Wars characters, what Star Wars fan wouldn't want to imagine what's going on in Luke Skywalker's head or Darth Vader's head or, you know, anybody's head.
Right. Oh, this is a lot of the motivation I think that people have for writing their own Star Wars fiction, and to be able to get in. And fiction obviously can do that in a way that film can't, where you get inside the character's head, which is really neat. Well, our listeners know that we just love Star Wars around here on this Harry Potter podcast, but some of you may be sort of wondering why we're doing this and what the relation is to Harry Potter. And Ian, the reason we've asked you to come on Potterversity initially is down to this intriguing bit of text in the FAQ section of your website, which was spotted, we'll own it. It was spotted by our eagle eye producer, Laurie Beckhoff. And you said in the FAQ, you said, years ago, just after William Shakespeare's Star Wars came out, I wrote to J.K. Rowling's people and asked about writing William Shakespeare's History of Hogwarts, a play written by Shakespeare, who was obviously a wizard, with Godric Gryffindor, Helga Hufflepuff, Rowena Ravenclaw, and Salazar Slytherin as the main characters. They very politely said no, and here you've got a little smiley face. An intriguing little smiley face. Okay, so we want to know all about this. So what are the Shakespearean elements that you see in Harry Potter? You know, open-ended, tell us more about the project. And what echoes of Shakespeare would you like to particularly play on with Harry Potter?
Yeah, so there's a lot in those questions. So let me unpack first of all sort of where the idea came from. After Star Wars first came out, I didn't know what would be happening next. And I think that was, I'm trying to remember the exact timing of that. It may have been because we decided to do The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi to adapt those very shortly after Shakespeare's Star Wars came out. So my guess is that it was sometime in the period sort of right around when those second and third adaptations were coming out that I was thinking, what will I do after this? And thought, you know, what are sort of the other big cultural movies and books that people love that could be adapted in a fun way into a Shakespearean context? And it also has to be something that I know and love, because otherwise it doesn't make sense for me to be doing it. Mm-hmm. And Harry Potter rose pretty quickly to the surface there. And so what my thinking was, you know, there's kind of no sense in, over the years, for example, some people have asked me to do a Shakespearean Lord of the Rings. My feeling is,
wow.
You know, why would people read Desher when they could just read Tolkien, right? Is sort of, yeah. Sort of my feeling about that. And I felt the same way about the Harry Potter books, right? Which is, you know, why, I mean, they're already such delightful and wonderful books. Why would you want to pick up another written adaptation of that book necessarily?
Right.
And so instead, wouldn't it be cool to have, you know, a different story, a new story within the Harry Potter world that is, you know, telling about something that we all sort of know happened, an event that we know happened, but is not retelling something that J.K. Rowling already told perfectly well. And so in terms of Shakespearean elements in Harry Potter, the Harry Potter books, I mean, there's so much there. I mean, anytime you talk about relationships between fathers and sons, particularly sons trying to live up to fathers who are dead and gone, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking, of course, about Harry and James. You know, I mean, there are echoes of Hamlet there. When I was thinking about this question before the podcast, I was actually thinking, like, you know, thinking about the four houses of Hogwarts coming together and forming makes me think of the, you know, like how you would adapt the first two lines of Romeo and Juliet, right? Four houses. All alike in dignity in fairest England where we lay our scene, right?
Like perfect.
It's perfect, right?
It works.
Like, it, you know, there you've got these four houses that are, you know, I mean, not all competing, but like they all have their own characters and that sort of thing, right? And so lots of echoes of Romeo and Juliet there. I think there would necessarily be in some ways echoes of some of the history plays. In some ways you are reporting what happened, right? In a sense, and
yeah.
And there would be some there would be some creative license, but there would also be some things that sort of have to happen, right? Events that readers would expect to be there because you hear about them in the Harry Potter book. So there are all kinds of different, Shakespearean themes that I think would rise to the surface in a book like that.
You know, one of the things that I really like about the idea of the project is that actually when Hogwarts was founded is a time period that like Shakespeare would cover in one of his history plays. And so there's something about rendering it into Shakespearean language that it feels like it would be right for that kind of, you know, medieval story.
Yeah, we're going to go ahead and greenlight you.
Yeah, oh, great. Perfect.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was part of it also, right, is that it did feel like this is exactly the period of time that Shakespeare might have written about. Yeah, it just, that was another reason that it felt like a really good match for a Shakespearean story.
Do you have any ideas about how you would be characterizing some of the founders in terms of, you know, like the, I sort of think of, Slytherin, Salazar Slytherin giving lots of soliloquies. You know, where he would be revealing his, you know, his innermost thoughts and, you know, even some of his schemes and, the motivations that he would have that would be in conflict with somebody like Gryffindor, who I'd get more like Henry V type, wartime language. And so I'm just curious about what you thought of as the characterizations of those founders.
I mean, I think where you're headed is right on, right? And this was one where from the start, when I had this idea, I thought I would have to go back and do a very careful reread of the books and of any time the founders are mentioned and what is talked about, because you'd want to make sure you got the characters just right. There would be, obviously there'd be plenty of people who would point out to you if you got it wrong.
That is the Harry Potter fandom. Yes.
Sure. I mean, and it's all fandom, right?
That's right.
I mean,
Star Wars is also that way.
Yeah. So I do think I would want to be really careful. And I don't know that right now I could say exactly how the different characters would be, but I do know that it would need to be a faithful portrayal of those characters, right? It would need to be what people would sort of come to it expecting and wanting those characters to be. I think that'd be important.
I would love to hear your version of the Sorting Hat, because, you know, the Sorting Hat would have to come out of the story, right? The Sorting Hat would have to result from the story. And so that I would love to hear some of your Sorting Hat soliloquies.
And actually, I mean, that's funny you say that, because in some ways the Sorting Hat does have soliloquies.
Yeah.
In the books. Yeah. So it'd be all, I mean, that's what I mean by research, right? Like, figuring out what are those things that would have to come out of this play.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about Rowena Ravenclaw and her daughter and the tragic love story there. And then the ghostly elements, you know, we've got these ghosts at Hogwarts, and that gives you all kinds of, you know, Shakespearean potential.
Right. And when I mentioned Shakespearean elements, I didn't even talk about the supernatural things, right? The magic makes me think immediately of Tempest or Midsummer Night's Dream or something like that. And of course, all the ghostly elements too, right? In doing the Shakespeare 2020 project last year, rereading through the entire canon, I was amazed to be reminded of how many of the comedies and tragedies rely on some element of the supernatural. I mean, it's well over half, of them. And so that, of course, fits very nicely into the Harry Potter world.
I thought also, you know, I see this a lot in the Star Wars versions that you gave too, but that sense of destiny and a story that has a certain destiny to it. And one of the things that I really liked about how you were able to use Shakespeare to suggest that people are aware of their destinies, like Obi-Wan. And you can imagine that that would be something you could absolutely inject into a Harry Potter version.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a sense in which there's only one way this story can go, right? Which also feels very like sort of Greek tragedy, to me. Like, no matter what you do to try to make this story go a different way, it's going to go the way that it's been written, basically.
Right.
Do you think it would be a tragedy, the story of the founders? I was just trying to think about that myself, whether it would be tragic or whether, I mean, I know it's a history, so it's its own kind of thing, but do you think ultimately it's a tragic story?
No, and actually, I think that that word history is chosen really carefully, because I do think that is sort of the category it falls into, where you can have tragic elements and you can have comic elements, and I think I would be trying to have both. But ultimately, what you're telling is a history of something that happened. But I think the only, you know, the only things that Shakespeare wrote about England and certainly like contemporary England were the histories. Other than, I mean, there are things like Lear, which is sort of ancient English history, or something like that. But my point being that like I think if he's writing about Hogwarts, again, if I'm thinking of the fictional Shakespeare writing about a fictional Hogwarts, right? Like,
right.
He's thinking of it as history, I guess, is where I'm going with that.
We're deep in the metafiction.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Going back to A Second for the Sense of Destiny, and Katie was plugging the original trilogy versions that you've done, but I, of course, when I was like, okay, I'm going to dive in to some of these Shakespearean versions of Star Wars. And of course, I went straight for the prequels because that's who I am. And that's what I love. And I just wanted to plug The Phantom of Menace for sure, because I have, folks, I've been reading this to my 9-year-old and he is eating it up. It is fabulous. And you're right, those little moments of soliloquy for characters like Shmi, who really gets a short shrift and who conveys so much with her facial expressions in the films. Yes. And her little bits of dialogue, but her soliloquy when Anakin leaves her is just, I mean, I was starting to like choke up when I was reading it. My son's like, ugh, mom, like, you don't get it. You never will. It's fine. But this is good. This is good. So, and going back to the supernatural element too, you said this, I love your aside in your FAQ that we quoted earlier. When you say Shakespeare, who was obviously a wizard, can you say more about that?
Well, I think that was sort of a tongue-in-cheek comment, right? I mean, it's basically like if you're looking at the world and you're separating the world between wizards and muggles, right? You know, like, then
as you do.
Just about anybody who is revered or liked or has the creative flow to them, right? Somebody like Shakespeare, you're going to be like, that person was probably a wizard, right? How else did he make... leave a legacy of complete confusion and leaving people wondering who he was and how he did what he did. Yeah.
I think he failed to modify some memories along the way.
Yeah, that's right.
Or succeeded too well.
But what a fun idea to imagine Shakespeare at Hogwarts. What house would he be?
Right. That would be a good question for her. Was Shakespeare a wizard? Yeah, maybe she'd respond to that. Maybe that would be just too tempting not to respond to.
Right, right. That does seem like a good J.K. Rowling baiting sort of a question.
So do you think that Rowling, I mean, she has so many influences in Harry Potter. Are there specific elements of the Harry Potter stories that you think are particularly Shakespearean, or like their plots, the characters that you think she's kind of directly borrowed from Shakespeare?
I think I can't give a super direct question to this. I would want to, and believe me, I'd love to sit down and reread all the Harry Potter books, but it's been a few years. So I guess I can only think of sort of broad themes, right? And I think, mm-hmm. I think that essentially any author who is calling on some of the sort of biggest themes that you'll find in fiction everywhere, right, are in some ways drawing on Shakespeare, who was often sort of either the person who did it first or did it best, right? And so, like I mentioned, you know, the sort of father-son dynamics between Harry and James, I think, feels very Hamlet to me. Some of the ambition and vying for power, you know, like some of those themes start to feel very Macbeth. Some of the battle things do feel very Henry V-ish, you know. I think that in some ways, her ability to let tragedy happen, you know, I'm sure you've both heard the joke, right? Like George R. R. Martin, Joss Whedon, and J.K. Rowling walk into a bar and everyone you've ever loved dies.
And I think, right, but unlike George Lucas, right, who always wanted the happy ending, you know, so this is kind of distinctive.
Right, that's true, yeah. And I think she is willing to let us live in tragedy and acknowledge that sometimes, you know, life doesn't go the way you want it to. And again, that's, I mean, that's not just Shakespearean, right? But it does at least, it does at least acknowledge that side of real human life. It feels much more real than something like Star Wars, where, you know, the good guys always win.
Mm. You know, one of the things that I thought would really, you know, and I know you were going to do the Founders, but I think particularly Voldemort, I find to be a bit two-dimensional as a character, because he's just, you know, he's just a sociopath. And so you don't have the sense of his human struggling. And of course, I guess he's not really human at the end, but I think that would benefit from a soliloquy or two, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even if he is sort of an Iago kind of a character, where, you know, Iago sort of hints here and there at different motivations that he might have for what he's doing, but you kind of get the sense that he's just going to be a villain, no matter, you know, what situation he's put in. But even then, you know, his soliloquies are just amazing. And so something like that, I mean, it was always my favorite thing writing for villains. I don't know what that says about me, you know, but like when I get to sink my teeth into a good Darth Vader soliloquy or Emperor Palpatine soliloquy, I love doing that. And I think it's that early fascination with Iago, you know, and so I would love to write some Voldemort soliloquies.
Was that thrilling to you, Ian, to see Ian McDiarmid reading from one of your works at a Star Wars celebration?
Yes, top. I mean, I would talk about like top 10 life moments, probably. Yeah. You know, yeah. And just to tell the story for listeners, it was at the 2014 Star Wars celebration. They must have sort of done the like pre-interview with him to prepare for the panel that Ian McDiarmid was doing. And they asked him what, you know, as a Star Wars fan, what some of his favorite things are. And he said, well, you know, I know it's stereotypical, but I rather like those Shakespeare Star Wars books. And already, so I have people like who are there texting me being like, oh my goodness, you can't believe he's saying this. But of course, they must have known he was saying that, because the next thing they do is they hand him a copy of The Jedi Death Return and say, will you please read this speech of Emperor Palpatine? And they like lower the lights and put reverb on his mic, and he puts on his Palpatine voice, you know, and there he is, like, reading my words, and yeah, that's...
Wow!
I think maybe we could probably find that video and link it in our show notes, so people can check that out. It is a great moment. I think they overdid it just a little bit with the reverb.
Yeah, they did, yes.
But it was so key.
Shakespeare don't need no reverb now. Yeah. That's funny. Oh my gosh, what an awesome thing to have happen. Just a real affirmation of what you're doing, Ian. That's just awesome. When you're translating these modern works into Shakespearean language, what are some of the challenges as you're doing that, and also making it something that's like a play, something that, you know, you're trying to put on an early modern stage? How's that translation? What are some of the challenges that you meet there?
Well, there are definitely times, and this I would say even more so with adaptations of comic moments. So I'm thinking especially when I did like Mean Girls or Back to the Future, you know, where some of the comedy relies on sharp, witty replies or dialogue. And that can sometimes get lost in the iambic pentameter when you're trying to put everything in meter, you know. Sometimes things that are really snappy end up less snappy. And so that's a challenge of figuring out how that's, you know, how that's going to go. I would say another challenge is any scene that is really well known, you know, and very famous, you know, it's a challenge to think about how much do I want to change this? How much do I want to leave it how it is because it's so revered or so, famous. I'm thinking about things like, you know, these aren't the droids you're looking for, or no, I am your father, or, you know, like these lines that have sort of become culturally so big. So those are definitely challenges.
But, you know, one of the things, Ian, that I think is interesting is that you also put in those lines that everybody knows from Shakespeare, you know, as you sort of tweak them to meet the moment. And so there's a combination of those that makes it actually a very successful mashup.
Thank you. And I mean, I do try whenever I'm writing something and writing a scene and I think to myself, oh, this really reminds me of X from Shakespeare. It's like, okay, I better. It's probably time to put in a reference to that, right? So if, when Luke is rousing the rebels before the final Death Star battle in Star Wars, you know, to have him hint at the St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry V
Oh, I love that.
felt, you know, necessary.
Yeah. And you know, I was, because I was curious, I was like, how's he going to handle the I love you, I know moment? Because I was like, I don't know how you can do that in iambic pentameter. But I, when I got to it, I was like, that was skillfully done. That was so well done. So that you get that sharp sense of, you know, you get the rhythm of the original kind of joke of it. I guess it's kind of funny and wrong at the same time. But so Han, so very Han. And just the handling of that. So that's interesting, because that I can see that you are you know, thinking about those. It's well known and it's snappy, and making that work in iambic pentameter.
And what a gift to have a form. I was just thinking about the person who picks that up in the bookstore or seeks it out online. That's going to be a person who's looking for what you're doing. You know, it's you're not going to. I mean, I don't know. I just kind of feel like you're the way you're. It's got to be a gift to have that kind of an audience who may well recognize not just the Star Wars outline and references, but also the Shakespearean nods that you give, obviously throughout, like the St. Crispin Day speech and. Yeah, so it's really neat. So you've mentioned what you do as pastiche. And so I assume you kind of see yourself as doing pastiche with Shakespeare and these popular properties. So tell us about pastiche as a form and how you think it sheds insight on both the work being imitated, in this case Shakespeare, and on the story that's being told.
So I think when And actually, I think the word pastiche specifically was a word first suggested by my first editor for Shakespeare Star Wars, and because we were trying to figure out how do we classify this, it's certainly not satire, right? But it also feels like something more than parody,
What is
and
this that we're
pastiche,
doing?
yeah, exactly. And pastiche feels, you know, I mean, as defined as sort of imitating another writer's style, that feels like the closest thing to what I'm trying to do. Because one of the things that I didn't want to do from the start, we've all seen really bad Shakespearean parody, I would say, right? I would where you just sort of add F to the end of every word, and like therefore eth I am eth sounding eth Shakespearean eth, you know, and like. And like that sort of is the lazy person's way of like doing Shakespeare, you know. And I didn't want to do that at all. I really wanted my, and of course I would never claim to be the artist that Shakespeare was, or to have his abilities. But I still wanted my adaptations to really do honor to him more than just sort of be cheap knockoffs. And so I wanted to make sure I got the language right and got the meter right and, you know, tried to get a lot of it right. And that to me, I think falls into that category of pastiche more than it does into other types of writing, other styles of writing. And I think, you know, in terms of So the insight into Shakespeare, I think, is hey, look at all these things that Shakespeare did, and you can recognize his devices, you know, that he used. And I mean, I didn't necessarily until I sat down to write these things, you know, I wouldn't have thought of some of the literary devices that he uses. They were in my head as, oh, this feels Shakespearean, right? And it wasn't until I sort of did the research and even in some cases ended up learning the names of things like Anaphora and Stichomythia and you know, things like this that I didn't know what it was except that I knew it was Shakespearean, right? And so I think it can help us sort of to look at those layers of what he's doing and how well he's doing it. And then I think it helps tell the stories because yes, I am just you know, in the case of Star Wars, I am just sort of retelling the stories of these movies, but I'm trying to do it in a way that is shedding new light, both in a meaningful way, hopefully, with some characters, like you mentioned Shmi, you know, where I'm trying to give her something more and something deeper, and also in just fun ways, right? Where like, you know, there are dialogues and fun moments where I'm just trying to give a bit of comic relief in the same way that Shakespeare often did with some of his more minor characters and things like that. So if it's working well, it's going both ways. It's both doing honor to him and sort of giving new life to this familiar story, because of the unique things that he did in writing his plays.
Yeah, and folks, Ian fixes Jar Jar Binks in The Phantom of Menace. So I just, again, that's probably the only thing I need to say to endorse this book for you to read, is that he fixes Jar Jar Binks. So I mean, he becomes a Shakespearean fool who's really not a fool. I mean, you know, in Shakespeare, the fool is usually, you know, one of the wisest people in the room. And so Jar Jar is that, which is very refreshing.
That was one of those really fun moments where I saw in the Word document that had been passed over to Lucasfilm and then returned to me with their comments. I saw my sort of interpretation of Jar Jar Binks. I saw it like on the. I saw one comment from the person at Lucasfilm who's my main contact and who edits my manuscripts, and she had written, "Story group, is this okay?" And so I sort of saw this moment where it was like, oh, this might not have been okay, right? And the story group is the sort of group of folks at Lucasfilm who maintain the consistency of the Star Wars canon, right? And so she was asking them like, can we do this? Is this legit? And then the like reply to that comment was from one of them saying, love it, or something like that. And so like I saw this moment where like it might have gone away, but it didn't. And so that was a
Yeah, big
big
exhale.
relief. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
So, Ian, what are your next projects? And like, if J.K. Rowling and, you know, her corporation, whatever, were to change their minds and, you know, give you the A-OK, would you still be open to doing that story?
I would still be great fun to write the history of Hogwarts. I would love to do that. I would love to dig into that world and in some ways sort of get to a chance to make it my own. Yeah, I would love to do that. In terms of what I'm working on, I have two more books coming out this year. One of them, as was mentioned, is it's called William Shakespeare's Avengers: The Complete Works, and what it is it's a four play. It's a single book, but it's four plays, and it's the four Avengers movies rewritten as Shakespearean adaptations.
Oh my gosh, I
And then
love
I
it.
have my first non-Shakespearean book coming out, but it is in the Star Wars world. It is a book of poems for children called "I Wish I Had a Wookiee," and it's sort of essentially like if Shel Silverstein wrote poems about Star Wars. Is sort of the gist of them. So that's a project that's been in the works for like 6 years. I think
Yeah.
I started working on it
Wow.
in 2015. So it's really fun to see that one.
Well, I know what I would get Emily for Christmas, except that I know that she will buy that as soon as it comes out. So she
Yeah,
will
you
not
know what?
wait till
My
December
son
25th.
and I already spied it on your website, and he got really excited about it. He was like, "Oh, can we get that? Can we?" And then we like immediately went to the library and searched for it. I'm like, "Oh, it's not out yet. Okay, all right." So it is on our radar screen. It really is.
I knew it.
He's very excited about it. He's hoping you have a poem about clone troopers because that's his favorite.
I think there's some clone adjacent poems in there. Yeah, I
Oh,
think
that'd be
so.
great.
Yeah.
I do. Yeah, I can't wait to get to the clone material in the prequels because they do. It does feel like a very Shakespearean element. In some strange way, it feels. You know, I'm desperate to know what Shakespeare would do with this, so I'm relying on you, Ian, to give me a good idea of what Shakespeare might do with this.
One of the things I've loved doing is giving myself these sort of personal writing challenges as I've written these adaptations that nobody else is asking me to do, and is not necessarily warranted by anything in the movies, but that I just decide to try essentially. One of my favorite books is Good Ol' Escher Bach by Douglas Hofstetter, and he peppers throughout that book dialogues between the tortoise and the hare. And he, one of the dialogues is called Crab Cannon, and basically it's a dialogue in which all of the so the first line of the dialogue it also becomes the last line of the dialogue, and then the second line becomes the next to last line, and that sort of, and then they sort of meet in the middle, and he manages to work it out so it all makes sense. And so when Obi-Wan Kenobi goes to Kamino to visit the people who are actually doing the cloning and creating the clones, I wanted to do something really special with that. First of all, it's split into a few scenes in the movie, and I turned it all into one single scene. And I wanted to do something special with it. So I, the cloners dialogue does that same thing where, so it's the lines of dialogue, you know, the first line of that they speak in that scene also is the last line that they speak in that scene. And the second line they speak is the next to last line. Maybe it is lines
Oh,
of my own
wow.
pentameter actually. Anyway, so that was
So
a
it's
really fun.
chiastic.
Yeah,
Kind of.
exactly. Yep. And so, it was just a really fun challenge.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's
Well,
neat.
gosh, keep challenging yourself there,
Yes.
Ian, because
It's working
it's
out.
wonderful for us. And really, everything that you've done has just been is so well received. So that's just great. Now it's time for our special segment. And our special segment for this episode is Owl Post.
Look up. It's time for Owl Post.
Today's question from Owl Post comes from Lang and Bay. And the question is this: Darth and Kylo both gained some redemption, but did they deserve to? Is there any way Voldemort could have been redeemed? What do you all think of those questions?
It's a good one. You know, I mean, in my, the first thing that comes to mind is that Harry offers Tom Riddle, as he's calling him, in their final showdown. He offers him a sort of a chance for some remorse.
Right.
So yeah, in that sense, I think, well, I mean, I guess what's being implied is that if he would have taken that, he doesn't, of course, spoiler alert. But he if he would have taken that chance and you know, shown some remorse, you know, I think maybe there's a chance for that, but I also think that it probably would have destroyed him.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting it's an interesting question. I guess I don't ever I guess I don't want to ever believe anybody's beyond the chance for redemption. However, in the case of Darth Vader and Kylo Ren, they both at the end actually change their actions, right? To reflect a sort of new way of thinking. And I think you could well argue that maybe in the case of Darth Vader, it's too little, too late. In some ways, with Kylo Ren, I think maybe it's a little more earned, a little more appropriate. Either way, I think with Voldemort, yeah, I mean, unless there's something he's doing to sort of make up for what he's done, which would be quite the task, I think. It's hard to imagine.
Yeah, one of the things I was interested in this question was the concept of deserving redemption. And what you said, Ian, I think really kind of makes us think about that. You know, is it just saying you're sorry, you know, or showing a little remorse? Or does it require, you know, something more, something that has some sort of a reversing impact, or, you know, that some
Restoration.
restoration,
Yeah.
right? Yeah,
Yeah.
and I agree. I think Kylo Ren much more does that than maybe we say Ben
Ben, yeah, Ben Solo. Yeah.
than Anakin slash Darth. Voldemort doesn't even have a shred of it at the end.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he doesn't. Yeah, and Ben Solo, and the follow-up question I have was, maybe he deserves redemption, but does he deserve that kiss?
Ah, that kiss.
The most unromantic kiss ever. It's kind of like the hug that Voldemort gives Draco Malfoy in the film. I got stuck on that hug. And I was like, oh, that's the worst hug ever.
That was bad. Awkward.
Nobody wants that hug.
That's funny. That's funny. Yeah, even the, I mean, just the idea of deserving redemption. I guess I want to say everybody deserves. I don't mm-hmm. think redemption is something you deserve or not. Like, I guess mm-hmm. I hope everyone deserves redemption, but I do think redemption is something you earn or you don't earn, right?
Yeah, you take the opportunity for your own redemption in a way.
And there's kind of like all this religious dogma that's going on in my head about
mm-hmm. right.
about salvation. And I mean, I think it does, obviously the answer to that question is, you know, leans on your religious tradition. Because I mean, in a sense, in Christianity, nobody deserves it, period. Nobody ever did anything to deserve it and nobody earned it. But, you know, it's still given anyway. And then, you know, your chance to redeem yourself is your willingness to accept it, you know, and mm. your participation in it is your willingness mm-hmm. to accept it. But again, that's kind of a dogmatic answer. And I think, you know, if you're in a different, come from a different tradition, you may have a different take on it.
But I like this idea that your redemption is your acceptance of, you know, of.
Or your participation in the redemption. Yeah.
Yeah. Or, you know, your acceptance of the possibility of doing good after you've turned to the dark side. And, you know, Voldemort doesn't have any change. There's, like I say, I feel like he's kind of two-dimensional in that I don't see a lot of depth in him to be able to make the kind of change that Kylo Ren can.
So. Which is why we need a Shakespearean version.
That would be great.
You can read all about this in my upcoming book, Tom Riddle, Ben Solo, Cruella de Vil, and the Theology of Redemption.
Oh, awesome.
Is that another writing challenge?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yes, and Cruella de Vil, absolutely.
Lang and Bay, thanks for that awesome question.
That brings us to the end of our episode today. Thanks so much, Ian Desher, for being on the show.
Thank you again for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Well, best of luck with your upcoming projects. You know, I know there will be things on my Christmas list there. We're going to end today with part of the Sorting Hat's story of the history of Hogwarts in rhyme, though sadly not in iambic pentameter. 1,000 years or more ago, when I was newly sown, there lived 4 wizards of renown whose names are still well known. Bold Gryffindor from Wildmoor, Fair Ravenclaw from Glen, Sweet Hufflepuff from Valley Broad, Shrewd Slytherin from Fen. They shared a wish, a hope, a dream. They hatched a daring plan to educate young sorcerers. Thus Hogwarts School began. And the rest is history.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to pottervercitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.